We're wrapping up paper 32. We're in section 5, which is old single column, page 364. Okay. Now, as you recall, if you've been here the last couple times, we did those previous two sections, and in both cases there was a fair degree of challenging material relative to a very basic evolutionary starting point, if that's where you were coming from, really. And not a lot of breaking into the fifth epical revelation yet. There are some things that were definitely challenging you about the nature of God and your relationship to God. And so it's interesting to see something that they often do when they know that they're challenging us pretty hard. And we might be getting a little bit kind of thrown off kilter a little bit, needing to kind of get our footing again. They give you, and it's usually at the end of the paper then, of course, they give you some soaring poetic passages to try to help you to remember you haven't lost sight of, you haven't, and you shouldn't have lost your grip on the truth that you probably had even as a very simple, steeped in evolutionary religion person. If there's any genuineness to your religious experiences, there's a genuine relationship with God, His majesty, His integrity, His absolute love. That's solid, the solidity of your actual relationship to Him. Beyond your attempts to understand it, in some sort of a rational way, to have a theology, as it were, to understand your relationship with God. So, so they do it. They give us some real soaring passages here, and kind of interestingly broken into a beginning chunk and an ending chunk with a little bit of detail still in the middle. And definitely the way it literally ends, the very last two paragraphs of the paper are very familiar to longtime readers. That's some of the most soaring stuff in the book that everyone remembers, maybe probably the first time they read it. It was so made such a strong impact, so influential on your relationship with the revelation. Okay, so let's jump in and see what they have to say here.
Number 5, the eternal and divine purpose. There is a great and glorious purpose in the march of the universes through space. All of your mortal struggling is not in vain. We are all part of an immense plan, a gigantic enterprise, and it is the vastness of the undertaking that renders it impossible to see very much of it at any one time and during any one life. We are all a part of an eternal project which the gods are supervising and outworking. The whole marvelous and universal mechanism moves on majestically through space to the music and the meter of the infinite thought and the eternal purpose of the first great source and center.
Now, the one little thing there, and just noticing how there was one little word there, it was a little different than the way you read it. It's even stronger. And it's not, at the end there, it's not the music and the meter. It's the music of the meter. Because two things. First of all, just throwing in a reference to the meter. So even when the passage is quite soaring and poetic, and so they know that you are feeling your relationship with unity again. You know, if it kind of got lost in all those details that you just waded through, they're not going to let you just have that unity. They want you to have an equal amount of individuality. You know, the meter, you know, that's about individuation and even the measurement of it, the preciseness of it. You know, and to put them together, not just juxtaposed with an and, you know, but to see how, you know, to see them more intimately related, the music of the meter. That, you know, I mean, if you just think a little bit, the whole concept of harmony is dependent upon, you know, a prerequisite of individuality. I mean, even a chord is not one note. Okay, let alone some more complex expression of harmony. See, so they're trying to get you to make that transition from spiritual to cosmic. To see that individuality is not an enemy for that unity that you sort of just innately feel and desire once you have some spiritual consciousness. It's actually the means to the only kind of genuine unity likeness that you can experience. I mean, none of us are pure spirit beings that somehow only have experience with some sort of a, you know, perfectly uniform unity or something. I mean, you know, if you think about it, all of your experience is individuality. I mean, your whole sense of truth, beauty, and goodness, and everything began in the midst of individuality. So these tendencies that humans have to get off thinking that somehow that's to be rejected and moved away from to this more idyllic state, which you've never experienced. So how do you know what's more idyllic? Right. Yeah. It's trying to get you to, you know, to get out of this long-standing mode, see, of rejecting the material, the individuality, the measure, the, you know, which, you know, makes you come ungrounded, untethered, and you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. See, so they never miss an opportunity, even in the midst of, you know, and you know, purposely throwing in great, even because, you know, they want to really have it soaring, the first great source and center. But meter, you know, throw in that, you know, that grounding word. Okay, so, but you see, you know, it's just like the title says. They're trying to make sure you haven't lost sight of your effort to engage, you know, the largest grandeur that you can conceive, you know, and have that be the backdrop of your life's efforts always. So then, see what else they throw in here.
The eternal purpose.
Oh, you got something?
Yeah, you know, this. Sorry. How long could you contemplate the eternal project?
Eternally. Yeah.
Eternally.
Yeah. Right.
It's like,
how long will it take you to complete the eternal project? Right.
Never. Yeah. Project, that kind of gets me.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You're trying to project into, you know, that eternity. But that first great source and center, you know, can complete an eternal project, you know, in no time at all. He does it in eternity, so eternity is not a reach, especially when you're infinite.
Really helpful.
Yeah, that's handy. Right, so, yeah, just, and I'll comment on that just a little bit, you know, as soon as we read the other paragraph here. Yeah.
The eternal purpose of the eternal God is a high spiritual ideal. The events of time and the struggles of material existence are but the transient scaffolding which bridges over to the other side, to the promised land of spiritual reality and supernal existence. Of course, you mortals find it difficult to grasp the idea of an eternal purpose. You are virtually unable to comprehend the thought of eternity, something never beginning and never ending. Everything familiar to you has an end.
Okay. So that last sentence, they're obviously transitioning into something we'll get into in, a, you know, in the next paragraphs. But so the first thing, you know, very fundamentally, they're reminding you that no matter what kind of a worldview that you're attempting to live in, no matter what level of complexity of individuality you're trying to figure out a way to engage and navigate, you're always to be attempting to eternalize your consciousness. And reminding you of that, that that overriding effort that you should always have in everything that you do, to attempt to eternalize your consciousness in relationship to all things. Now, you start out as an animal origin creature, you start out locked totally in the moment. When you start to use your higher adjutants a little bit more, you know, it can take you out of the moment a bit. You know, you have a little bit more of a long-term consciousness. But once you, you know, are striving to strike step with the cosmos, you know, you're trying to take that way beyond just some sort of a long-term. You're trying to actually begin to contemplate the fact of eternity in the midst of your temporal life. You're trying to get a longer and longer term view of things to stabilize you know, the bobbing cork in the ocean phenomenon that is your animal origin nature. You know, to get yourself into a longer and longer plank, you know, that can bridge wider and wider chasms, you know, of the roller coaster ride of life on a mortal world, especially one, you know, that's had the issues that our world has had. And so you need that eternalization you know, of your consciousness. Okay, and when they say things like, of course you mortals find it difficult to grasp the idea of an eternal purpose, you are virtually unable to comprehend the thought of eternity, something never beginning and never ending. When they say sentences like that, don't cop out. Don't go, oh, well, they're giving me permission, you know, to be as limited as I was the day I came out of my mother's womb. You know, why even bother? Well, you know, look carefully at the sentence. You mortals find it difficult. And, you know, as a mortal, yeah, it's you're practically, you know, virtually unable, okay? But even the word virtually, you know, is giving you some wiggle room of recognition. I mean, the more you strike step with the gifts that have been given to you, the more possible it is for initial inklings of eternity, at least, to be there in your mind, just if you're striving towards it, especially when you think about the adjuster. I mean, the adjuster literally, at its core, embodies eternity. You know, it's of eternity. And through the mystery of mysteries, it can bring even eternity and infinity down into relationship with your very lowly mind. So, yes, you're not going to have some sort of a very direct relationship with eternity. You're virtually unable, right? But, you know, if you're striving, if you're reaching up and trying to stretch out, the adjuster can work with that effort on your part. You know, it's always subservient to your will, but But it can work with that and try to bring eternity down a little closer and a little smaller, you know, find some sort of a downstepped sense of eternity that you can begin to feel in your mind. You know, so don't ever not be striving just because, I'm a temporal being, I have to think in terms of beginnings and endings. It's like, well, yes and no. I mean, your agitant mind, your animal origin nature, yes. But if you can start to reflect and start to have some insight of a significant nature, eternity and infinity don't seem as remote anymore. I mean, yes, they're abstract, but you can stretch your mind into being comfortable in a more abstract space. You can feel like you know what's going on there. It's not just all fuzzy and mystical or something.
Isn't that cultivating?
Right, it's to take the light and cultivating, of course. Then there's a big paragraph break. They wanted to do that first. So remember, you probably had some sense of eternity. Your great thinkers have been striving to understand it for a very long time. If you know anything of the history of philosophy, for instance, you'll know about how people have been efforting to understand this and express a relationship to this. So they're trying to get you reminded of that.
So, and then they notice the last sentence, they leave out the beginning. Mm-hmm. They put everything familiar to you as an end versus a beginning and an end. I've often wondered why they did that on that sentence, as opposed to everything familiar to you as a beginning and an end.
Which is the more ominous thought in your mind, your birth or your death? Which one do you sweat bullets over? Right.
Well, only because something never beginning and never ending. I mean, everything familiar always has both.
But you can see why they put that, because it's transitioning into the next paragraph.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's the main reason, but. It's also there just because of what I said. I mean, you read about all this wonderful and think about all this wonderful eternity stuff, but then that little nagging animal origin voice says, yes, but I'm afraid of dying. What about dying? What?
Pam is saying that she can't hear what John said.
Let's see, now I can't even remember. It's been so long.
Beginning and end.
Yeah, Pam, he was just bringing up the issue about that last sentence, just saying end instead of beginning and end. That last sentence of the second paragraph.
Yeah, it is more familiar to us than our beginning.
Because we do have a beginning, but maybe not an end, I guess is the way to...
You potentially don't have an end, yeah. But you have to... You have to try, it just because you contemplate eternity doesn't mean the end goes away. See, so it's also there to remind you of that. And that's why, like I said, it's transitioning about what they're just going to talk about next. That can you bring these two into relationship, the eternal and the temporal? And the most, definitive thing, in your mind about temporalness is death, the end, okay? So they're juxtaposing those purposely, just like they said the music of the meter. They're trying to take two things that historically there's been a dichotomy about. Where you have people that try to just stare at eternity and hum so they don't remember about time, or those that just poo-poo the notion of eternity and say, well, time is just time, It's obvious, it's right in front of our faces, why are you trying to deny it? And it's like, no, it's not one or the other. It's both. How can you, and he's about to try to give you some philosophy to help you think about bringing the two together, how they're not oil and water, they're not black and white, they're not, they're not a dichotomy, they're not antithetical, okay? All right, so let's see what he does here now, and before he goes back to poetry at the end, he's going to make us think a little bit here.
As regards an individual life, the duration of a realm or the chronology of any connected series of events, it would seem that we are dealing with an isolated stretch of time. Everything seems to have a beginning and an end. And it would appear that a series of such experiences, lives, ages, or epics, when successively arranged, constitutes a straightaway drive, an isolated event of time flashing momentarily across the infinite face of eternity. But when we look at all this from behind the scenes, a more comprehensive view and a more complete understanding suggests that such an explanation is inadequate, disconnected, and wholly unsuited properly to account for and otherwise to correlate the transactions of time with the underlying purposes and basic reactions of eternity.
Okay. So that's a lot of, you know, very precise sounding words and obviously thoughts behind them there at the end of that paragraph. So like I said, see, he's wanting you to go into a philosophic mode. He's wanting you to try to reflect on individuality and unity together, to use your budding ability to associate, use some of your budding objective perspective to rise up above that dichotomy and that seeming dichotomy and to begin to see how you can harmonize the two together into an understanding of how such an obviously temporal fact as yourself can have some relationship with a God that must be of eternity, or he's not a God that you see any reason to believe in. I don't want to believe in some temporal, anthropomorphic, lowercase g God. I want to believe in the one, capital G God, you know, who must inhabit eternity. So how do I think about bringing this together? And see, you notice how they tried to, you know, draw that stark contrast between eternity and time that I was mentioning right in the middle there, that, you know, you initially, it looks like all these temporal things that you might think about, lives, ages, epics, you know, or even just, you know, a passing experience, all seem to have a geometric analog, you know, or a way of analogizing what you're experiencing. It's like, well, it seems like time is this line, this straightaway drive that is running through all these various things, ages and epics and lives. And you're going, so I've got, and not only is it a line, but it's a line segment, and often a very short one. It's got a beginning and an end. And as you begin to have a consciousness of ideals, you know, and transcendent things, you have this backdrop, like you're saying, behind those line segments. You know, there's this big infinite sheet of eternity that's a backdrop. You know, how do they say that there? You know, these momentary, flashing momentarily across the infinite face of eternity. You know, these little line segments juxtaposed against this. Okay, and it's like, wow, those are just very different. One's not a line at all. The only thing I can imagine it is just an infinite sheet, you know, going off in every direction. And I'm not even two-dimensional here. I just have this linear segment. And it's like, what the contrast there? Okay, so now he's saying, now this is a mighty messenger who's been to eternity back many times, existential eternity. And so when he says, but when we look at all this from behind the scenes, so in other words, if you begin to have a more objective perspective on the finite, in particular temporal finite experience, you begin to see it sort of behind the scenes a little bit more, like he has. You begin to get initial understanding of the relationship between time and eternity. I mean, you obviously would have to begin to get some sense of it if you've gone in and out. You know, now I'm in eternity on the aisle, now I'm out in time, now I'm back in eternity on the aisle. I mean, it's like, you know, you'd start to get the sense of how they're linked together. Okay? And so that's what he's saying. You know, when you begin to reflect on that, especially when you've had experiences like he had, you see that thinking of time is some, you know, analogizing it in terms of geometry as a line is just not adequate. And to that point, you know, think about the history of thinking about time. I mean, that's fundamentally the way humans have always thought about time. It's just a linear idea, concept. And when we got more and more scientific, it was very much codified like that. And finally, when you get to the beginning of the 20th century, especially with general relativity, you very definitively codified it. You literally now believe that time is one of those meter things. You know, that you can, that the line segment isn't just a geometric analogy, that it's literal. It's a literal extent, an extension. You think of it as a fourth dimension relative to three spatial ones. You know, that's like it, and that it has an extent, you know, that it's just there laid out, and you can move back and forth along it, you know, and you develop a whole science fiction of time travel along that imaginary meter, temporal meter line. You know, now I'm at, you know, the 11, you know, tick mark, now I'm at the 35 tick mark, now I'm at the, you know, like that. Okay, there is no such thing. And the first hint that you are taking your analogy too literally is when you attempt to express this mathematically in relativity, you have to assume that that yardstick is not like the three yardsticks that give you X, Y, and Z. You have to assume that that yardstick is imaginary, that the numbers along that line are imaginary numbers and not real numbers. So it's a first hint that, see, you've overplayed your analogy. It's obviously not literal. In order to make it literal, you had to literally use imaginary numbers. Okay. So between the lines here is a reminder of that. All that mode of thinking, the whole worldview, even if you're not even remotely scientific and have never even, you know, thought in detail about relativity or anything like that, I mean, you've listened, you know, you've gone to movies with time travel and you've read books of time travel and it's oozed into our pores now after many decades of this phenomenon. And no, there's none of that is a valid worldview. That doesn't exist. Time is not a metric like that. Okay, but as you're going to see as he goes forward, if you can, it is a helpful analogy to use geometry to analogize the relationship between time and eternity. To use geometry, but don't take it literally. Okay.
Okay, and then how come Jesus is not time bound? What's the difference there?
Right. So you have now to go into those details. You've got to look at
a little scientific stuff. Right. Not scientific, science fiction to me, so to speak, as you mentioned.
Right.
Okay, I'm trying to understand that one.
Right. So for the people on the webinar, he's asking about, what about when they talk about Jesus not being limited by time? Okay, how does that work? Well, you have to go to the redefined word time in the fifth epical revelation. You've got to know what the proper definition of time is. Instead of thinking of space and time like we always have as, you know, in some way equal, and like I was saying, in modern science, even more equal, you know, trying to play them as if they were the same thing, the Revelation says no. Time is not a fundamental element. Space is a fundamental element, but time is not. The two fundamental elements are space and motion, not time. And that the thing that you call time is just the chronicity of motion. Okay, so it's a secondary aspect, you know, an abstraction, if you will, of the one of the fundamental elements, the motion. Okay, so when you say that Jesus is not limited by time, okay, he's not limited by the normal chronicity of motion. Okay? Everything is a motion. It's a universe of motion. Everything is a motion. And so if a creator being is, you know, like Michael, is engaging that universe of motion in the evolutionary domain, there's an evolutionary chronicity to the motion in the evolutionary domain. You know, if you mix two chemicals, if you mix hydrogen and oxygen together and you make water, okay, it takes a certain amount of time for that physical process to occur. I mean, it happens really fast, and that's why it's explosive, okay, but it's a measurable time between, what you start with and what you end with. You know, there's a certain time constant.
Like changing water into wine.
Right? There's a certain time constant involved in all of these processes. For you to go from a child to an adult takes time. Everything takes time. Okay, because there's a certain motion that just has a chronicity to it. Okay. He doesn't have to follow the normal time constants. Okay, it normally takes a long time for wine to age. When you go, that whole process of the molecules in wine rearranging to take on the flavor of an aged wine, there's all those time constants involved and all those chemical processes, they all add up, and it takes a long time. Many years, perhaps. Yeah. Okay, he doesn't have, it's okay for him to skip over those normal time constants. He won't be in rebellion against the supreme, against the God of evolution, the God that fixes those time constants for chemical reactions. Okay, he can just go from an initial virgin molecular arrangement of wine molecules to an aged arrangement without waiting the time. You know, you can tell them just, he can tell the master physical controllers and stuff, it's okay, skip all of the normal supreme time constants, just put the molecules in the aged arrangement.
Okay, and then when they say in another place that to God all time is present at any one time, does that mean, remember you were talking about the scale going back and forth, that from God's point of view, he can be at any point in time, at any time, so to speak? Is the past always the past, or is the past also eternal, so to speak?
Well, see, actually, he can't be at any time, at any time. God the Father is outside of time. And we don't want to go too far in that, but you'll see he's going to get into it a little bit here, so I'll speak to it a little bit. But, that's kind of what we're trying to get at. Can we begin to get some sense of what the relationship is between time and eternity? In other words, what's God's relationship to where I am? Okay? If he's very much eternity, I'm very much time. A lot of thinkers throughout history thought, well, that just means that there can't be any relationship between the two of you. That God can't have a relationship to you because he's purely eternity and you're purely time. And then that gets more and more skeptical, and eventually people are saying, and of course, if you just really think about it, that just kind of proves that God is a delusion. That you're just making this up. I mean, something that you can never experience, probably something that doesn't exist. Okay? And you sort of prove that you can't experience it if you definitively conclude that you're purely temporal and God is purely eternal and that twain can't meet. Okay? So that's what's going on here. Like I said, this is very much trying to invoke the whole history of philosophic reflection on the relationship between God and man and between time and eternity. I didn't put them in the same order, but you get the idea. Actually, let me just say it up front now, as long as we stopped on that. To get into the precise details of how to link the two together, that's something that we do in the Reawakening Philosophy, the first part of the Reawakening Philosophy seminar. We had a whole session of the 15 sessions devoted to sorting this out carefully, resolving all the conundrums of the history of philosophy using the revelation. And when you do that, you discover why, because we've just gotten into it, there's several more paragraphs like this about time and eternity, you discover why this set of paragraphs talking about the relationship between time and eternity is right next to some sections talking about your relationship to God, because they're actually dealing with the same issue. Once you figure out what the precise relationship is between time and eternity, you can answer the question precisely, technically, why God is not personally present in the universe like they just told you he wasn't. Instead of just accepting it because it says so in the Revelation, you can deduce that from first principles. Once you reawaken philosophy and get a solid philosophy going, you know, we did that. And the first time we went through the Reawakening Philosophy course. So we're not going to go into all those details because there's a lot of, you know, precursor to all that. But nonetheless, that's what he's invoking. He's encouraging people to do what we started doing. Establishing a philosophy that puts all this, takes all this out of fuzzy space and makes it definitive. You understand exactly what, you know, what the finite is and what eternity is and how the two are connected together and how that limits God's relationship to it. Okay, let's see. Wait, before you read some more, do we get the main elements there? Let's see, we got the straightaway drive. Let's see. And then just, you know, his statement that there's a, I mean, basically the way he was ending that with all those kind of complex, not very precise words is alluding to the complexities of what you have to do to put it on solid ground philosophically, like I said, you know, we did in that course. Okay, so let's read some more here.
To me, it seems more fitting for purposes of explanation to the mortal mind to conceive of eternity as a cycle and the eternal purpose as an endless circle. A cycle of eternity in some way synchronized with the transient material cycles of time. As regards the sectors of time connected with and forming a part of the cycle of eternity, we are forced to recognize that such temporary epochs are born, live, and die just as the temporary beings of time are born, live, and die. Most human beings die because, having failed to achieve the spirit level of a juster fusion, the metamorphosis of death constitutes the only possible procedure whereby they may escape the fetters of time and the bonds of material creation, thereby being enabled to strike spiritual step with the progressive procession of eternity. Having survived the trial life of time and material existence, it becomes possible for you to continue on in touch with, even as a part of, eternity, swinging on forever with the worlds of space around the circle of the eternal ages.
Okay, it's a lot there. Let's kind of go back and step through it. Okay, so he's saying, don't totally throw out, like I said, don't throw out your geometric analogy, even if you recognize, don't take it literally, about the line, to begin to think about finite time, or, you know, the time that you experience as a finite being. He said, now, so to go with the geometric analogy, let's think of eternity. Think of a geometric analogy for eternity. Let's think of it as a circle. Instead of a little line segment, let's think of it as a circle. Okay, and you know, he also brought in the cycle thing. We'll get to that in a second. But let's just start with the circle analogy part of it. If you think about a circle, there's two parts to that circle. There's its circumference. If you go around, what's the other fundamental element of that circle? The center. Right. In order to draw that circle, you have to, you know, start with a center point. Okay? So when you think of a circle, you know, don't just think of, you know, the circumference part, but think about the fact that it invokes a center point. a point. How could I very simply relate that circle with its center point to a line segment? Well, a line segment is this whole bunch of points. I could overlay that circle on the line. The center of that circle of eternity touches this point on the line, and this point, and this point, and this point, and this point. So along your thoughts about, okay, how can you begin to picture in this geometric analogy how eternity relates to time? The center point of eternity is that infinite sequence of points along a line. Yeah, so eternity is at every point. Now, the eternity we're talking about here, if it's not obvious, is existential eternity. That existential eternity in this geometric analogy is going to be like this circle with a point. And that eternity engages every point along the temporal line. Okay, because it has a center point. Okay, so existential eternity is right now, you know, engaging right now and right now and right now and right now and right now. It's at everyone, an infinite number of points. Okay, so that's how he starts. Now he also said, you know, think about a cycle. Okay, you know, beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, there's a cycle. You know, like he said, born, live, die. So, you know, he's wanting you, you know, if when you think about the time that we're used to thinking about, like I said, if you think of that as the chronicity of motion, you know, it's like, well, okay, like a motion going around and around like this, okay, and it has an ongoingness, a chronicity to it. You know, and if I'm going to, time is going to be, or eternity is going to be related to time, and I make it a circle, you know, he's saying, look, you know, you could imagine a dynamic circle instead of a static one, you know, so that there's a cycleness to that circle, okay? But this is existential eternity. You know, and he's talking about in some way synchronized, okay, with time here. And he's saying, start with just the more immediate thing that you would see as a downstepped expression of that cycle of eternity in time. You know, an existential cycle in time instead of an experiential cycle. So instead of thinking like you as an individual being born, living, and dying, you know, and then maybe invoking reincarnation and going around the cycle again. So instead of thinking of an experiential cycle of an individual, you know, especially if you put it in a reincarnation mode like that, where you're going around and around that born, live, die cycle, okay? Think of what he's saying. You notice how he's talking about the born, live, die. He's talking about it existentially. Not just one individual being born, living, dying, then being reborn, living, and redying, and, you know, but just the existential fact that everything that you observe has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's born and lives to die. You know, some age, you know, the Bronze Age, you know, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, everything is like this. He's saying, so think about that. If time is in some way a downstepped expression of eternity, and there's a cycle aspect to eternity, and we're talking about existential eternity, you would see this existing everywhere. That all these finite phenomena would just exist in a cyclic way. They'd have a beginning, a middle, and an end, whether they're things or beings. So that's what he's pointing to. Now, that's sort of an immediate existential footprint of eternity, that all these temporal things have that cycle to them. They just exist that way. Okay? But then experiential reality is, you know, is a further elaboration, a further downstepped expression, you know, and there is some truth, you know, like they point out, even to a simplistic idea of reincarnation. Your ascension career has cycles to it, especially early on. It's almost exactly like people have thought about reincarnation. The only difference is instead of their imagination didn't go beyond a plane. Their whole universe was a plane, and so they went around and around a circle in a plane. And the revelers just say, well, you know, that's factually not correct. But there's a truth there. If you just make the circles go up in a spiral, you know, especially as you're going through the mansion worlds, you know, you've got this life here, and you die, and then you're repersonalized in the mansion worlds, you go through a cycle there, and that body dies, and they make a new one for you in the second mansion world. You know, you mean you literally go through reincarnation-like cycles on those first ones. I mean, there's you have to, you know, be unplugged. You know, you lose consciousness. They literally throw out your old body, make a whole new body for you, you know, and put your soul back in it, and then you start again, you know, on each of those. You know, but you leave behind the last resurrection hall in the seventh mansion world. You don't have to actually do that almost literal reincarnation-like thing, you know, like you're doing to get up the mansion worlds. Okay, so see, there's so he's saying, yeah, so even in an individual, if you go to experience of an individual, you can see a shadow of the cycles of eternity like this, that you had to sort of go on around and around a cycle to get up. You couldn't just go linearly up. Okay? All right. So let's see, what else do we have in there? Okay, now. The other thing, you know, when he says some way synchronized, I mean, it's not like that anyone can see, you know, even who's experienced time and eternity. It's like, well, I can see the cycle of eternity, and I can see the how the shadow gets cast, and that makes all these born, live, die things. I mean, that's not overt. So, you know, he's saying it's some way synchronized, but he knows it's causally linked. You know, that it's connected. Let's see. And so then he says, as regards the sectors of time connected with and forming a part of the cycle of eternity. Okay, so now he's taking the analogy into a little bit different space. And when you get to paper, the beginning of paper 105, when you get to the preface of paper 105, they pick this up again. And they say, now, even better, geometrically, if you want to work with this analogy, instead of thinking of a circle, think of an ellipse, they say. You know, and when they tell you that, and there's no explanation, they don't explain why you're supposed to do that, they just tell you to do it. But once you figure out what the heck they're alluding to, and you make the infinite eternal ellipse chart, that paper is trying to get you to discover in relationship to the beginning of the foreword, you know, to actually begin to think in deity. When you lay the deity out in an elliptical pattern like this, okay, and you figure out that in the fifth functional level of total deity, which is the creature identified domain, you know, basically you can think about you're being engaged here in this sector, okay, especially if I made this an even more, you know, pronounced ellipse, then when, you know, conform to an 8.5 by 11, you know. But you can see, the thing is, if you make it an ellipse instead of a circle, this part of the ellipse down here starts to look a lot like a line. Okay? And if you made it even more pronounced ellipse, it would be even more like. See, so from a very localized perspective, you're just sitting here and you have a very limited field of view, you go, you know, looks like it's a line to me. You know, if you look at that tiny little bit of the ellipse right there, it looks linear. But as your, you know, as your perspective broadens, you go, wait a minute, the Earth isn't flat. It actually curves, you know. And, you know, this cycle is not, this is not a straight line. It's a cycle, and it actually curves. Okay, that's why they're suggesting an ellipse, just so you have a way of even more definitively thinking about how this initial straight line sense, things where you're just going from here to eternity in a straight line, how you would have that perception because you're looking at a very short segment of a very, you know, gradual curve. Just like they tell you, you know, even if you when you go to the Isle of Paradise is so big in literal terms, you know, that from way back from a distance, it looks like there's a right angle, you know, as you go from the upper surface to peripheral paradise. You know, when you go way back, it looks like a sharp pointed right angle. They tell you if you actually go to paradise and stand on that seeming point, it looks as flat could be. I mean, that parent right angle is so, because the aisle is so big, you cannot see any curve, you know, as far as you can see, it looks perfectly flat. Okay, so, you know, that's the idea. Relative terms, the ellipse gives you even a better analogy.
Not the two foci on the ellipse either.
No, not with the two foci. It's the whole point of flattening it so that there's a quasi-linear section that you begin your consciousness in. That's the point of it. Okay. And it's, you know, but that's the only spot where they do that. The rest of the time, they just, you know, let it be simply a circle or a cycle, you know, like this. You know, but when they want you to get really technical in 105, they say, now think of it as an ellipse if you're ready to get technical. Okay, it's the, and it's that, in that sense, the sectors of time connected with and forming a part of. See, where you literally, instead of thinking of that as a line segment with this big infinite sheet as a backdrop, that's eternity, now you're going to, instead of making eternity that, you know, infinite sheet, you're going to make it a circle, or even better, you could make it an ellipse, and then that line could be a part of that ellipse, that quasi-linear part of that cycle. See, forming a part of. Okay, so that's what they're getting at there. Okay, and then they invoke the, you know, like I'm saying, there's this existentialness of born, live, die that you see that reflects that cycle of eternity. And then this whole bit about, you know, if you don't actually achieve fusion in your mortal life, what, you know, how do they fix that problem? They give you a longer line segment, right? I mean, that's what the mansion worlds are an extension of your line segment. Because there's you can't get away from the fact that initially, in many ways, you really, you're a potential part of that closed figure. You're not an actual part of it. And so initially you can think of, you're given a line, you know, and a tree falls on you or whatever, you just, you know, run out of lifespan and you don't fuse yet. You know, so they make your line longer. They just make the line long enough that eventually you can strike step with that center point of that circle at some point along that line, and you can strike step with eternity. Now, the other thing that's really handy about the circle, and it's another reason why they, when they talk about the cosmic levels, they invoke the analogy of the psychic circles as a way to think about it, you know, invoke a relationship to the central universe, to Havona. And, you know, I've furthered this. So in that analogy, if you think about, here's yourself, and this adjuster comes down and inserts itself within your mind. If you think of that adjuster as this infinite rod, you know, goes all the way up to the infinite level, and it's a circular rod that comes down and penetrates with its end dipped down in your mind. And using the psychic circle analogy for your growth, so you start as a seventh circler. So you got this rod with a certain, you know, radius in the middle here, and you've got this great big seventh circle. And you go to sixth circle, and fifth, and fourth, okay? Till finally, and you get down to first circler, that circle, see, is like a circle of eternity, okay? And you've gotten your circle down to the same radius, okay? And now you're a first circler. And then you work on rotating it like this to synchronize and lock onto it between first circle and fusion. But again, to think about, you know, it came from eternity. It embodies eternity. And look at this geometric analogy of thinking of eternity as a circle works there too. That's why he's suggesting it. It's a handy analogy. You can play with it a lot, see, to gain a better understanding. You know, so, you know, you're making this kind of linear progress of decreasing your radii of, you know, and trying to strike step with a circle of eternity that's done inserted in your mind.
Don is posing a question. He mm-hmm. said, when Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, yeah. we shall not all fall asleep, but we shall all be changed in the twinkling of an eye. Did he possibly have in mind adjuster fusion at some distant future time, or is this account totally off course?
Just, you know, and when you think about some of the things that Paul said, remember there's a very, very intriguing little tidbit, little disclosure they throw in. I can't remember now exactly where that is. Somewhere in the midst of these 2,000 pages of text, there's a little reminder that Paul actually had some direct awareness of some of these higher things about the next lives and the adjuster. You know, that's why you have that line in Romans 8:16 that's so close to factual, you know, that the capital S Spirit testifies with your spirit, lowercase s, you know, that you're a child of God. I mean, that lowercase s Spirit, that's the adjuster. You know, the Revelators point that out. I mean, that isn't just a coincidence. You can take that sequence of words from Paul and interpret it that way. And when you first put the adjuster parenthetically, you go, oh, they're taking Paul's word and saying I could interpret him that way and he'd be more truthful. Then they say, no, it's actually in that case, Paul actually had a pretty good sense of what he was talking about. He knew that each individual had their own spirit fragment, and that's what he was talking about in that sentence. You know, so historically, we don't know that Paul had that level of awareness of some of these things. Okay, so, yeah, when you think about some of the things, you know, when he talks about getting a new body, you know, and these sorts of things, it's because he understood that, you know, that in the next life they're going to give you this new, better Marantia body, because he'd seen those things. So yeah, you can bring some of Paul's statements really alive because of that one little passing reference in the Revelation that it's not just coincidental that you can use Paul's words in really clever ways. Where is it?
539 under Gerasim citizenship.
Yeah, okay.
Paul also had a view of the ascended citizen corps of perfecting mortals on Gerasim, for he wrote, "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, the grand assembly of Michael, and to the spirits of just men being made perfect."
Yeah, yeah. And not to mention, like I said, a number of other things that Paul says, you know, that are not just coincidentally really close to the facts. Let's see. Now back into this. So that whole bit about, you know, the line segment that you have in this life is only so long. I mean, for instance, even when you have everything fully biologically uplifted and purified and everything, I mean, you know, you're still only living 500 years on those light and life worlds. And they tell you an amazing statement that you finally get to that point with these basically, from our perspective, perfect material beings, you know, living 500 years. And they say, and more of them are reaching third circular in their lifetime. And you're going, oh boy, maybe I'm not very high in the circles yet. Right. So even in that context, see, you can only make this line segment for this life so long, and then you get to the end of it. So, I mean, death is easy, like they're saying, is the only, you have to get a longer line segment to have more time to complete the process of finding a way to go beyond, you know, being just along a line and going through the point of a line and into the circle that it's the center of to strike step with eternity. And you kind of go through the looking glass in a sense. I mean, you know, you have to go to zero and out to eternity. You have to. That's what you have to do to strike step, and that takes time. Okay.
The attainment for him was pretty simple. The attainment for us is a little bit trickier.
Mm-hmm.
So enlightened life, that attainment, is there some kind of non-linearity there?
Right, see, yeah. Yeah, I mean, for those in the webinar, if you couldn't hear that, he's just, you know, I've commented about, you know, it's amazing to think about someone way back, you know, in ancient times, Enoch, you know, fusing during the, you know, which was obviously not an extremely long mortal life, you know, and yet we all live and die and, you know, don't even get close to it. And it's because the Supreme is evolving. And what the Supreme demands of someone thousands of years ago is not as much as what the Supreme demands of us now. Now, we have to achieve fusion in an it's not an existential thing. You have to evolve to strike step with eternity. See, and that what you're evolving through is a moving target. The Supreme is evolving. So when you're in light and life, you know, what's being asked of you is so much greater than any of us could even remotely achieve in 10,000 years, you know, let alone 500. So everything is taken, you know, to him who much is given is much expected. You know, I mean, everything's been given to those beings in light and life. And so, I mean, the things that are expected of them, I mean, you know, they get deeper in light and life. I mean, they have to learn the super universe tongue, you know, while they're still immortal. And I mean, these things that are just so completely beyond our ability now, you know, not even, you know, you can't even remotely ask that of us. You couldn't have asked that of Jesus 2,000 years ago. I mean, he was a man of his time. He couldn't have achieved doing those things that the mortals do in light and life as a mortal. It's not possible, you know. So, if he hadn't been killed, he wouldn't have lived to be 500 years. I mean, he's a man of his time, okay, and all the biologic divots, you know, in him. So, you know, just think about that, you know. I mean, you can... it's easy to falsely exalt the fact of Jesus. Jesus is relative to his time. You know, when you go to a world that's set way settled in light and life, okay, you'll see humans, you know, millions of humans living lives that Jesus couldn't have imagined living 2,000 years ago, way beyond, you know, what he was manifesting.
But if he had been born in light and life.
Right. And some, I'm sure some Michaels do their seventh bestowal on worlds that are way settled in light and life. I mean, they do them everywhere, you know. Okay.
It's then all he would relative. Have achieved.
Right. Then he would have achieved, you know, he would have gone beyond anything that anyone in that age could imagine achieving, you know, and he would have just boggled their minds. Right.
Would have done it at 30, just like he did.
Right.
Well, the Supreme is... Well, it's an embodiment of the whole. But we have universes, or we have systems, or at least planets in our system, that haven't even had life initiated yet.
Right.
Okay. So they're a part, and they have to evolve through every step of the way to get to... Eventually, it'll have to be spun up to get coordinated, but there's still an individuality there that's separate from the whole.
Right.
From the whole.
Right. So for those on the webinar, if you can follow, he's just pointing out how there's this difference between, you know, what an individual world can achieve in a local system where there's still many worlds that haven't even gotten life implantations yet. And that's why when you read about that light life sequence, you have two different sequences. You have the sequence of what's achieved on an individual world, independent of other worlds. And then there's what any given world can achieve once a local system is settled in light and life. And then you have a constellation settled in light and life and a local universe settled in light and life. See, you know, once you have a world where the whole local universe is settled in light and life, you know, one of those individual worlds... Even though if it's been settled individually in light and life for a trillion years, you know, or something, I mean, it's still now in the wake of the whole local universe being settled in light and life can do things that it couldn't do before, achieve things that it couldn't before. More and more, the whole demands of the Supreme are being imposed upon the small on parts. You know, until finally, in order for everything, for the grand universe to settle in light and life, everyone has to achieve a level of light and life status that embraces the whole seven super universes, not just a local system or a constellation or a local universe or even a super universe. Anyway, so every world, even the ones that have been settled in light and life for hundreds of trillions of years, will still have whole and huge challenges ahead of them in those final epochs of getting the seven super universes settled together as a grand universe of light and life. Yeah. Things that they can only do once they have more of the universe that they can leverage off of. You know, this distinction is vital. See, this whole, you know, it's all about that. Everyone is trying to come into relationship with the whole. And because that would be impossible to come into relationship with some massive whole right off the bat, that's why there's a hierarchy of wholes, wholes, a hierarchy of universes. You start small, get a relationship with that and get bigger. Yeah. So, right, it's this whole evolutionary process. But, you know, remember how they tell you, in order for you to achieve those final steps where you can get that spirit fragment from the Supreme Being and become a seven-stage spirit and be lifted up out of the finite and all that, in order for you to do those last things, you can only do that if you're in harmony with every other being and automaton in the grand universe. Everyone has to do it together. And if there's even the slightest lack of synchronization of everything and every being, it won't happen. You know, think about how profound those last steps are. I mean, like I'm trying to stress, it's not just every being, it's everything as well. Those last choices that you make are going to synchronize with every being in the grand universe and every automaton in the grand universe. There may even be shades of relationship to the, you know, at least the first outer space level in those choices too. Okay, it's some sort of incredibly impossible thing to imagine, because you're going to the power personality synthesis stage. Right.
Eternal project.
Right. I mean, that sounds like an eternal project itself, and that's just simple, trivial step one. Okay. I mean, relative to the first outer space level, the grand universe is negligible. It can be ignored in scale, you know, in scope. It's nothing compared to what, you know, you're going to be doing in the next age. Okay. Yep.
I thought it was important for the bestowal of the Sun Man as a prerequisite to life and light. And it sounded like, maybe I misunderstood you, it sounded like you said he could come during light and life.
I mean, the whole bestowal son thing. You're correct. I mean, in terms of literally being a bestowal son, but you know, we don't know about what other things might happen. Remember, they're not giving us all the story. I mean, they've given us the ascension scheme and the things, you know, in that sequence where the most that a Michael son could do was be the bestowal son, which is before a Trinity teacher son, which is before light and life. Okay, but what about what he's doing with other worlds and other schemes? And, you know, I mean, are there other bestowals that they haven't revealed? And things? I mean, we have no idea what they might not be revealing. Okay? All we know is just that very limited thing. So, you know, what he might be doing relative to other modes is completely unknown. That's what I was thinking in so those lines.
Yeah.
Right. You just,
because he's gone out of our order. So
right. See, you know, there's things like that. I mean, you don't, you know. I mean, even in a normal ascension scheme mode that they've given you the normal mode, you know, run of the mill process, even there, you got to be careful about saying, well, he couldn't ever do his seventh bestowal in that sense, in another world. You know, I mean, maybe sometimes there was a bestowal son, but then he comes in light and life, you know, and is doing something else. See, I mean, There's always those possibilities. I mean, if he can come before a magisterial son, I mean, basically then, you know, if he wants to change the rules, he can change the rules. Oh, yeah, I mean, that's what I think. You don't know exactly how to qualify that.
It's interesting what you kind of alluded to a second ago in terms of, you know, the more that is given to you, the more that is required of you in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
So given that we get this right now, maybe, you know, other people that are, let's say, maybe a lot more spiritual we are and have can reach those circles because they don't have as much knowledge to be able to have to put together, like you were saying, you know, on a planet of light and light, they maybe, you know, sometimes get to the third circle, which, you know, seems like, gosh, if they're only getting that third circle, I mean, we're nowhere near there, mm-hmm. and yet it's all relative in a way, right. Correct?
Right. So, yeah, and, you know, just the only thing that I would toss into that, you know, just please. Always challenge yourself to remember that when you're talking about the circle progress, those are cosmic levels, not spiritual levels.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so, see, you know, it's more difficult, depending on the age, in the sense of to achieve a cosmic, you know, to wrap your mind around a cosmic achievement, to encompass it with your personality, can have all kinds of degrees of complexity. If all you have to do is harmonize these four bowling balls, thinking, okay, if I arrange them like that and I wrap my personality around them, okay, I got it. You know, but if you're handed 100 million BBs, okay, see, and this is the thing, the higher you go in the cosmic levels, the finer the individuality becomes. So you're doing these more subtler and subtler, more and more refined harmonizations, and that's why it gets, you know, more difficult. You may have basically the same amount of unity, but you have so much more individuality that you have to bring that unity into relationship with. You know, it's pretty simple to, you know, if I have one individuality and I have unity, it's like, well, those seem kind of like oneness and unity. They're almost the same thing. They kind of match right up. As soon as you have two, it gets more complicated than the three. I mean, see, that's what you're getting at. You know, it's having to strike step with more and more individuality. That's what I was saying. When you think about what's happening as you're going towards grand universe, settled in light and life, you as an individual have to have a harmonious relationship with more and more other individuals, both things and beings, more and more and more and more until you're somehow taking it all into account. When we talked about worship on the Isle of Paradise, I brought this out that you get your first sense of that when you're there on the Isle, and you have this this incredible synchronization thing that you have to strike step with. I mean, you can't just be Mr. Island Universe and waltzing around on the Isle of Paradise doing whatever your will demands. You have to bring your will into absolute conformity with the system there, the law there, you know, and you have to take into account every being, you know, and everything you do. And that's why you have all these supernafim trying to teach you all of this, you know. Fortunately, you're not doing anything too fancy, so you just need a kind of a slight little relationship with the whole thing, you know. But every time you go back, it's going to be a bigger challenge to be there on Paradise. Because you're going to have to engage it at a higher level, you know, and So that's just, you know, so that process in eternity, see, is downstepped into time. And we see it like we're describing here. Okay, let's see. Think what else we have there. So just this having survived the trial life of time and material existence, it becomes possible for you to continue on in touch with, even as a part of eternity. There was that other thing. Yeah, where did they say that? Oh, yeah, here, right before that. I knew there was another thing there. When they say that you, escape the fetters of time and the bonds of material creation, thereby being enabled to strike spiritual step with the progressive procession of eternity. Okay, now there is where, so you start out with some line segment, and, you know, it probably has to get lengthened. But at some point, you do manage to fuse with your adjuster. And what they're pointing out there is, at that point, it's not like suddenly now you live in the circle and the line disappears. No, you still are living what appears to be a line. The difference is, now instead of a line segment, the line becomes infinitely long, if you go with the analogy here. That's what, see, this progressive precession of eternity. Okay, at that point, you finally, this line extends out to what we call experiential eternity. Once you actually have achieved, this immutable relationship with existential eternity,
which is fusing
for us, then your relationship with time gets stretched out to the future eternity, to the experiential eternity. You now have the potential to experience forever. Until you fused, you didn't have that potential. You were just a line segment with an end, okay? No matter how long it was because of all the mansion worlds, okay? Or maybe, going all the way up to Salvington and being a sun fuser, your line segment gets really, really long, okay? But it still has an end, okay? But at that point, no, then it goes on. So there's a literal experiential eternity now way off in the distance that wasn't there before. So there you can see how these two eternities that we talk about, see, relate to each other. Relationship with that existential eternity, opens your line segment up to experiential eternity so that it's infinitely long. Now, obviously, when it really gets really long like that, you're going to start to have more and more relationship with the curve. Even if it is an ellipse, you're going to start to feel the bend of the ages, okay, in your mind as you begin to relate to things on a greater and greater scale. And that's why they're bringing in at the end, they're swinging on forever with the worlds of space around the circle of the eternal ages. And remembering that the more you eternalize your relationship to time, the more you're extending your relationship to space, to infinity. That's why the title on it is the infinity hyphen eternal ellipse. More and more, when you strike step with time in a real sense, you're striking step with the two together. They go hand in hand, kind of in the way we just talked about. The more you strike step with personality, the more you have to take into account power too, because you're moving towards a power personality synthesis. You have things spread out through space and beings, extended through time, and the two are coming together. Okay, so that's why they invoke that. It's like, well, wait a minute. Why are they talking about, literally like our ellipse of the super universe is going around? Because they're saying, well, higher levels, space and motion, or the chronicity of motion, space and time, are a system together, but not in a simplistic geometric sense like, Einstein posited with general relativity. Okay.
The sectors of time are like the flashes of personality in temporal form. They appear for a season, and then they are lost to human sight, only to reappear as new actors and continuing factors in the higher life of the endless swing around the eternal circle. Eternity can hardly be conceived as a straightaway drive in view of our belief in a delimited universe moving over a vast elongated circle around the central dwelling place of the Universal Father.
Okay, see, that last part, she's just stressing what I was just saying, the relationship between space and time. That they know that on the grandest scales, the two are synchronized in ways. And so if you see a spatial form that is closed like that, everything wraps back around in circuits, that has to reflect motion that pervades that space. I mean, motion has to be able to strike step with that curve of space. And time is the chronicity of motion. See, abstractly, time is related to that curve. Okay, so that's what he's invoking there. And then again, just that thing about the flashes of personality and temporal form, et cetera. Again, he's reminding you of that simple little relationship. If you think about a cycle of existential eternity, how when you see that in time, in terms of just an existential expression in time, you'll see a beginning, middle, and end. And then there's new actors, you know, a beginning, middle, and end. You know, it's right, you know, just, it's going to be everywhere. It's just the way things are. It's existential. Okay. So it's just, you know, he's just wanting to stress those two points again there. Okay?
Frankly, eternity is incomprehensible to the finite mind of time. You simply cannot grasp it. You cannot comprehend it. I do not completely visualize it. And even if I did, it would be impossible for me to convey my concept to the human mind. Nevertheless, I have done my best to portray something of our viewpoint to tell you somewhat of our understanding of things eternal. I am endeavoring to aid you in the crystallization of your thoughts about these values, which are of infinite nature and eternal import.
Okay, so starts off, frankly, eternity is incomprehensible to the finite mind of time. Okay, it's not incomprehensible to the mind of your adjuster. Okay, now the adjuster can't give anything to you very directly, but he can give you some sort of downstepped shadow of his very clear understanding of eternity. Okay, so again, you know, don't cop out, you know, when it says things like that. Just remember, you know, don't try to do this as an animal. Okay, look up for help and then start working on this. The adjuster can definitely help you to eternalize your consciousness. It's of eternity. If anyone can help you, it can. And then just look at the admission. Okay, this is a mighty messenger. I mean, you know, who knows how many trillions of years old he is, okay, and how many times he's gone in and out of existential eternity, on and off the aisle, okay. And see, even for him...
I do not completely visualize it.
Okay? Right, I do not completely visualize it, okay? Because again, he can't see it with sort of sight-like, you know, seeing, sort of external seeing, but he has insight, and he's been fused with an adjuster for a very long time, this mighty messenger, okay? He has great insight. He can feel it. He can feel that relationship to eternity, even though, even now, he still can't really visualize it. But he understands it logically, you know, he can feel intuitively that relationship. You know, like he's saying, even if he could see it better, it's still fundamentally rooted in intuition. It's not something he can give to you. You have to discover it yourself by looking up and taking delight in cultivating. All right, but then at the end there, again, I've been stressing, don't, you know, take the easy path out. You know, when they remind you about your animal origin nature and say, well, yeah, what can you expect of me? I'm just an animal. Okay, move on to the next topic. I am endeavoring to aid you in the crystallization. Does that sound fuzzy? The crystallization of your thoughts about these values, which are of infinite nature and eternal import.
It sounds like art.
Yeah, it is an art, you know, to take delight in cultivating and strike a step like this. He's pointing out you must do this, okay? And he's trying to help you. I mean, in many ways, there's, you know, between the lines there is, remember why you're reading this sentence. There's an emergency. And the fact that there aren't people who have crystallized relationships with the absolute is why there's an emergency. You guys are all very fuzzy, and you're playing with dynamite now. You know, you're starting to really play with spiritual energy. And there's an emergency. See, so he's trying to get you to crystallize, to ground yourself, to take delight in cultivating. He wants to aid you. And, that whole bit about figuring out a way to finally crystallize all this, that's the point of what we did in Reawakening Philosophy. Okay? Not to just have some fuzzy, you know, association between time and eternity, but to see if you can very definitively, methodically, logically step it all through, lay it all out, and have a clear understanding exactly what's going on there. So that you can take your unity, which you've hopefully have had for a long time, and bring it into relationship with all that precise individuality and have a cosmic perspective that was not even remotely possible before. There's never been a human on this planet who has brought their unity consciousness into a into relationship with a precise understanding of time and eternity. If you do that, you'll be amongst the very first humans on this planet to ever do that. You're doing cosmic things. You're doing harmonizing things that have never been done on this world before. Now, the more of us that do it, the more is going to be expected in the future. Right? It's like, well, you know, grade school kids can do that. You know, now in high school, you have, you know, things move on. Right? I mean, none of us could remotely pass first grade on a world in light life. Right? Yeah, so again, it's just, you know, very important to stress, you know, don't try to live with just that fuzzy thing. Start to try to challenge yourself to come into definitive relationship with some of these things. That's what they're trying to get us to do. Okay, so enough about all that complexity. Big paragraph break. Take a deep breath, and let's do the poetry that wraps us out here.
There is in the mind of God a plan which embraces every creature of all his vast domains. And this plan is an eternal purpose of boundless opportunity, unlimited progress, and endless life. And the infinite treasures of such a matchless career are yours for the striving. The goal of eternity is ahead. The adventure of divinity attainment lies before you. The race for perfection is on. Whosoever will may enter. And certain victory will crown the efforts of every human being who will run the race of faith and trust, depending every step of the way on the leading of the indwelling adjuster and on the guidance of that good spirit of the universe Sun, which so freely has been poured out upon all flesh. Presented by a mighty messenger temporarily attached to the Supreme Council of Nebadon and assigned to this mission of Gabriel of Salvington.
By Gabriel of Salvington.
Bye.
Yep. Okay, so let's do that last little thing first before we talk about the poetry a little bit. So, you know, here's one of those exceptions where it's very definitive. Okay, so even though we're talking about a mighty messenger who isn't literally, the offspring of the Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit, you know, and amongst the local universe children, he's one of the 12 individuals who's in the Second Revelatory Commission. You know, he's telling you that he's one of the 12. He was assigned by Gabriel. So you know one of the 12. It's this mighty messenger. Okay. Other times, you know, it's not at all apparent in any way whether or not this is just someone who got assigned this by the commission, you know, to do this paper, or if he's actually one of the 12 that's on the commission. But here you can see this is definitely one of the members of the commission. But it shows you, so when they get assigned, when a mighty messenger gets assigned to a supreme council of a local universe like this, he's treated as if he's a local universe citizen. It's like Melchizedek and Veranda Dex and whatnot. I mean, so it's a very definitive attachment when they get assigned like this. He lets go of the cares of the bigger picture and really puts himself down in the local universe and gets assigned as if he was a local universe individual to tasks like this. Okay, now, you know, I mean, everyone loves this passage, you know, and it really doesn't need a lot of explanation. You know, I mean, you got to love. Let's put an exclamation point at the end of every sentence. Well, that's not enough. Let's put them in the middle of sentences too. And you know, it's one of those things where they.
Depends what comes before the exclamation.
Yeah. Right. I've never seen that in school.
Yep. So, I mean, other than, you know, having it for interjections, you know, like, wow, exclamation point, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but here they'll do it right in the middle of a great big sentence. You know, so there's that, which is really fun. But then there's little precise things, too. Notice when they said faith and trust. Did you notice the order there? Okay, when you first start thinking about those two together in an evolutionary context, it's with the third epical revelation. You know, if you go up, what is that, paper 92, where they list the five epical revelations, you know, and they tell you for the third and for the fourth, that both of them can be really summed up with two words. You know, like for the fourth, it's love and service. And for the third, do they say faith and trust? No, they don't. They say trust and faith. Okay. Here they say faith and trust. Remember, that order is significant. Okay, we're in this sweeping context. You know, the race for perfection is on, et cetera, here. We're not in a beginning mode here, where you've got the initial faint flicker of faith. You're trying to add trust to that. Trust is your foundation here. And you're taking currently unrecognized levels of faith and adding it to that trust foundation. So it's trust and or faith and trust instead of trust and faith. Isn't that paper 92? If I could... I'll make sure I'm not just saying that wrong. You guys remember which, you know, what's that one about the, is that the later evolution of religion? Isn't that the name of that paper? Yeah, 92, yeah. So on in section 4 of paper 92, when you get to the third epical revelation, Melchizedek of Salem is on page 1007, you know, you see in italics there, trust and faith. So just notice when they do that, they're trying to suggest something when they do orders like that, which is the root one, which, you know, which is being, you know, added on to that. Let's see, anything else there? No, I think it's pretty much self-evident. So let's see, we've got a little more time here. Why don't we get started on the next paper? Let's get into this a little bit. So now we're going to... we're going to leave the big picture of local universes in general behind. Yep.
I just wanted to mention.
Yep.
God is not personally present in the universe.
Right, in the universe of universes, yeah, per se.
However, the plan, the eternal plan, embraces this. We can feel the plan, his plan for us in eternity. It's not beyond our ability to feel and be a part of that plan. It's within our, maybe not grasp, but at least we can, it's not beyond our ability to experience, at least in a small way.
Right, right. And that's kind of, you know, when we were talking about that, you know, that attempting to subtly sense the Father indirectly, that's another way to think about it. And for those on the webinar, if you couldn't pick up all that, I mean, he's just focusing on thinking about that, even though the Father's not personally present, you know, the Universal Father's not personally present here, the plan is present and is playing out. And like they said at the starting point, the eternal purpose of the first great source and center. I mean, everything goes back. So, you know, the better you get at seeing the subtle things around you, the more you can see indirectly the hand of the Father. You know? And, you know, and you begin to feel just how transcendent the purposing is. It's like, well, there's transcendent and there's transcendent. I think that goes beyond supremacy. I think that goes beyond ultimacy, etc. And you're beginning to feel the purposing of something that's absolute and infinite. All right, let's read a little bit more here in paper 33.
Administration of the local universe. While the universal Father most certainly rules over his vast creation, he functions in a local universe administration through the person of the Creator Son. The Father does not otherwise personally function in the administrative affairs of a local universe. These matters are entrusted to the Creator Son and to the local universe Mother Spirit and to their manifold children. The plans, policies, and administrative acts of the local universe are formed and executed by this Son, who, in conjunction with the Spirit Associate, delegates executive power to Gabriel and jurisdictional authority to the Constellation Fathers, System Sovereigns, and Planetary Princes.
Okay, see, so coincidentally, just what Gene was bringing up there, see, is how they start out this paper, and just notice the challenge at the end. For our idealism, not only is the universal Father not personally present and, you know, acting as a direct administrator or anything, but this delegation thing that he does, it's not feeling too iffy when it's Constellation Fathers, but as soon as they say System Sovereigns and Planetary Princes, those of us who have some experience with such delegation, going, oh dear, but. Yeah, that's the way it's set up. So instead of having the Universal Father personally present, instead, you got Caligastia.
Not anymore.
Well, he's not in that function, but he's still here. And I don't think we've quite overcome the issues that he spawned. Yeah, as a matter of fact, like I've tried to point out, I mean, you know,
yeah.
One of the reasons why we have this revelation in our laps is because we finally now can have gotten up to the level where we can play the game at Caligastia's level and we can choose to join the rebellion or not. We've been too primitive and ignorant until now. And that's why there's an emergency. In our ignorance, many of us not only can now, but are choosing unwittingly to join the Lucifer rebellion. And you know, we think we're doing great spiritual things, and actually we're doing the exact things that he was doing, skipping all the evolutionary steps and going right to the spirit candy. That's what he wanted to do. Skip all those rugged details. Let's just jump right to the spiritual age. You know, that's rebellion. You know, and the people who are advocating for that have no idea that they're advocating for the rebellion. They think they're advocating for light and life. No, you're advocating for the rebellion. If you want to bring spirit, if you want to skip the Father's way, skip the experiential process and do the unity thing right now. That's what he wanted to do. He didn't want to do orgy of darkness and death. He wanted to do light and life. But he wanted to do it now and not then. So you get the opposite. Because the Supreme, you know, is not going to speed things up for you just because you want it to come quicker. You could care less about your timetable. That's the amazing thing, see, about a Creator Son, that they can actually, you know, not going to rebellion by skipping those normal temporal steps. They have permission, see, to do that, to order beings to skip the normal evolutionary sequence of events, to go from point A to point B.
But if we as human beings born in this world are our evolution in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they give us this revelation, isn't it, you know, part of our, feels to me like it's something we should do something with. Yep. You know, in other words, and because whatever we do is evolutionary, because we are evolution, it's not as bad as being, you know, or maybe as Adam and Eve, who knew different, who knew better, so to speak.
Well, but you see, now, yes and no. I mean, you know, you have to distinguish between evolution and revolution.
What's over-revelating versus, I mean, if the revelation's here, is it over-revelating?
Well, it's not over, you know, but it also, you know, can only reach a handful of people, you know, because of the high level at which it's attempting to engage us. Okay.
All high level people in this room.
Right, right. But no, I mean, just the whole point.
It can reach a couple million people, but maybe not billions.
Just the whole point is, you know, I mean, no matter how revolutionary some of the things that Jesus did were, you know, remember how they stressed that many times in part 4, that he was always evolutional, never revolutional. I mean, it's one thing to have evolution have a shorter time constant, to pick up its pace. It's another thing to be in rebellion against it. Right.
But talk about something going slow. Yeah. I mean, this revelation's going slow.
No.
The
ancients of days, I don't think it's going slow.
No, I'm just saying.
For those of us with 100-year consciousness, going slow.
Right. What is that 2.5-second thing about the rebellion?
Right, again, that's what I was...
What would it be for the Urantia book? Like, it's
right, yeah, nothing. That's what I'm saying. It's just nothing, yeah. Okay, let's get a little bit into Michael of Nebadon here.
Our Creator Son is the personification of the 611,121st original concept of infinite identity of simultaneous origin in the Universal Father and the Eternal Son. The Michael of Nebadon is the only begotten Son, personalizing this 611,121st universal concept of divinity and infinity. His headquarters is in the threefold mansion of light on Salvington, and this dwelling is so ordered because Michael has experienced the living of all three phases of intelligent creature existence, spiritual, morontial, and material. Because of the name associated with his seventh and final bestowal on Urantia, he is sometimes spoken of as Christ Michael.
Okay, so you can see the literalness of, you know, when he did those bestowals where he engaged the morontial and the material, he literally embodies those, and his his dwelling reflects his relationship, his very literal relationship to those things.
They put a trailer or a screen porch on his mansion room.
Maybe not quite that literal, but just you know, he's, you know, just, you know, they want to remind you, I mean, he's still Jesus, right? And he was Jesus, he still is. And they're pointing out his dwelling reflects that fact. Okay, and then the last thing, he's sometimes spoken of as Christ Michael. So literally, etymologically, what does the name Michael mean? So anyone remember?
One who is with God?
No, close, but...
Like a name.
It's a question.
Oh, what is
God? Who is like
God? Who is like God? Okay, Michael means who is like God. Okay, and so the significance of that name, Christ Michael, is that it's an answer to the question. Okay, the Greek word Christ means what? Anyone remember?
Anointed one.
Right, the anointed one. It's the same as Messiah. You know, means the anointed one. Okay? So, you know, when you say Christ Michael, you're stating the question and answering it. Who is like God? The anointed one is like God. That's the significance of that name. You know, so think of it dynamically like that. It's not just two words with pronounceable letters, okay? It's a question and an answer. That's why they, you know, carry that on high. Because it has, you know, significance beyond being a sequence of letters that you can pronounce in English. Okay, so so that's just the basics. We all know 611,121st in the sequence.
Can we talk about that for 2 seconds?
Okay.
There's only 700,000 of them.
No, there's more. But there's 700,000 that will be assigned to...
Do we really know there's more? I don't...
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they tell you. I mean, even if they do, even if you don't know...
They said there's reserved.
Yeah, well, even if you don't know that there's definitively more than 700,000, you know at least, even with a little bit of reflection, either 700,001.
Okay, so anyway, my right? point is that...
Because okay. there's the first
there's
born...
There's the latter ones, if there's numbers there. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're probably, therefore, you know... I always thought it meant that we were one of the newer universes out here, you know, with a latter Michael, because the 620 before him probably have
that's a universes. That's a pretty linear thought, though.
Yeah, I still like it.
I mean, are they how are they numbered? Are they numbered when they get assigned or when they're born? Or
yeah, but we're out way out in the end of nowhere. Right. And the oldest in the youngest universe. So right. I mean, it's not totally
no,
far.
No, you know that we're one of the one of the newer local universes. But you know, you have to be a little careful about trying
all
to apply
that
number directly.
All that does to me is make me, you know, think about how many trillions and trillions of years things have been going on. And it just sort of takes the whole picture of my old thought of God and my old thought of life after death and eternity and expands it beyond comprehension, so to speak, to where, you know, it's way more than I could possibly have ever imagined. And yeah. That's kind of an interesting thought for me, actually.
Yeah.
I just want to clarify something. Yeah. The seven super universes came into existence all at the same time. Right?
Yeah. But then the local universes get populated in some way we don't know and what the sequence is and all those sorts of things. But does someone, probably Chris might, does someone remember, just quickly, if we can read some more, all those trillions of years, you know, Sydney mentioned that little thing where you can do a back of the envelope calculation about how long ago things got started.
300 trillion.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can do a little calculation about how many trillions it's been since they set up the seven super universes, and the estimate from that is 300 trillion. So it's a lot of trillions. Yeah, they're ancients of days.
I thought it'd be more than that.
Okay.
Our Creator Son is not the eternal Son, the existential paradise associate of the universal Father and the infinite Spirit. Michael of Nebadon is not a member of the Paradise Trinity. Nevertheless, our Master Son possesses in his realm all of the divine attributes and powers that the Eternal Son himself would manifest were he actually to be present on Salvington and functioning in Nebadon. Michael possesses even additional power and authority, for he not only personifies the Eternal Son, but also fully represents and actually embodies the personality presence of the Universal Father to and in this local universe. He even represents the Father-Son. These relationships constitute a Creator-Son, the most powerful, versatile, and influential of all divine beings who are capable of direct administration of evolutionary universes and of personality contact with immature creature beings.
Okay, so just a couple things to note there. I mean, why did they, at the beginning, when they say Michael of Nebadon is not a member of the Paradise Trinity?
Because Christianity has a...
I mean, well, that, but But, I mean, the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, and the Infinite Spirit aren't members of the Paradise Trinity either, technically. Right? Why did they say it that way? Okay, that's because they're, you know, if you're initially trying to understand this, they're speaking to the Trinity of Christendom, right? Like John was just saying there. So that's the first understanding that they're trying to give you, that the Creator Son is not a member of what you initially think of the Trinity as, the Trinity, you know, some aggrandizement of the Trinity of Christendom, some association of three individuals. Of course, it's not, technically. But that's why it's said that way. So again, it's an example. You got to be careful. It's like, well, how do I know that? Well, go back and, you know, read where it tells you point blank that the Paradise Trinity is not the association of the three individuals, even the three infinite ones. That's the first triunity, technically. Yeah. The Paradise Trinity is a fourth fact. But
this is a good revelation, though.
But they're giving you, stepwise, giving you to it slowly. Okay, now, you know, we talked extensively in the previous paper about this whole bit of he actually embodies the personality presence of the Universal Father. It's like, well, okay, technically, how does that work? Personally, it's figuratively. Spiritually, it's literally. But it's in that context. So again, if you want the detail, you can't take that out of context. You got to understand it when they talk about it technically, like they did. And then there you see it very directly. What kind of deity, most fundamentally, is he's created? Is he made out of? His foundation is Son-type deity. And then you add Father-type deity, so it's Father-Son-type deity. Okay, and it's not a blob of Son deity and a blob of Father deity orbiting about each other or something, or you might stick an and between them. Okay, they're together as one. Okay, so it is the super additive consequence of bringing those two together. It's not an additive joining. So that's why they're saying, he can do sort of indirectly Father things and Son things, but he can also do the super additive consequence thing. He can do things that the Father can't do and the Eternal Son can't do, because he embodies the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two of them. Okay, so he's transcendent of them in some ways, even as a infinite being. So again, when you think about it from the top down, you start with them and then you go, we think you're going down to lesser things. Well, no, flip it around. You're really going up. He's something that the Father and the Eternal Son will never be, can't be. Just like we are. You are things that the Universal Father and the Eternal Son can't be and never will be if you embrace your potential. Okay, so there's that. And so at the same time that he has very transcendent things, he can also make personality contact with immature creature beings. So, like you're saying, he's a very wide-ranging, profound phenomenon. Right?
Our Creator Son exerts the same spiritual drawing power, spiritual gravity, from the headquarters of the local universe that the Eternal Son of Paradise would exert if he were personally present on Salvington, and more. This universe Son is also the personification of the Universal Father to the universe of Nebadon. Creator Sons are personality centers for the spiritual forces of the Paradise Father Son. Creator Sons are the final power personality focalizations of the mighty time-space attributes of God the Sevenfold.
Okay, a couple things. You see the more in italics, kind of like what I was just saying, because of that super additivity. Think about more literally, since he has this Father-Son nature, how handy might that come in if you have a fragment of the Father on the one hand and a Son of God, like one of us in the room here, on the other hand, and you'd like to unify those two. You'd like to bring those two together. Be really handy if you were literally the embodiment of the link between the two, between Father and Son. See, so that's why the spirit of truth, see, can serve work as a function as the spirit of unification and link, you know, the lowliest of sons of God to an adjuster. See, so personality centers are the spiritual forces of the paradise Father, Son. See, that the spirit of truth is one of those things. That's not Father, that's not Son, that's Father, Son. It's the spirit of unification between Father and Son. Father hyphen Son. So that's why that other name for the spirit of truth, see, is very appropriate. It's literally referring to what they're just saying right there. Don't forget, he's not Father and Son, he's Father hyphen Son. He is the two together. So he can give you that as a gift. Bridging that, linking time and eternity. Okay, and then they remind you that he's also, from an individuality viewpoint, you know, in the God the sevenfold. Now, technically, you know, that designation is not a collection. When you say God the sevenfold, that's actually a single personalization of deity. And it's nothing like we're talking about here. There's a type of deity called the sevenfold. And there's a personalization of that facet of deity. And we don't often talk about that. You know, from an individuality viewpoint, you have all these, you know, like all the supreme creators and this sort of stuff. I mean, even supreme controllers. There's a very subtle fact amongst all of that, this deity called the sevenfold, that in a way, you know, transcends all of this individuality. They're just reminding you there that he has that within him, something that sort of threads through it all. You know, when you look at, you know, the psychic circles on the sevenfold chart, you know, and see, if you just focus on the sevenfold creator, say there, none of those are a father-son. You know, there's, I mean, yeah, there's the universal Father, the eternal Son. I mean, there's a master spirit who's the Father and the Son, the fourth one. But there's, yeah, you see, that he's pointing out that, you know, by being part of the sevenfold, in a sense, he's got elements of all this stuff, but a lot of it is very recessive. It's not immediately manifest. The Son part is quite manifest. That's very dominant. The Father sort of is next. Now he's got some of the supreme. Okay. But if you want to get into thinking more, you know, about the really complicated deity picture, there's that, you know, usually unspoken of facet of deity, the sevenfold, which is very difficult to begin to understand. But they're reminding you of it here. Okay.
The Creator Son is the vicegerent personification, no, personalization of the Universal Father, the divinity coordinate of the Eternal Son, and the creative associate of the Infinite Spirit. To our universe and all its inhabited worlds, the Sovereign Son is, to all practical intents and purposes, God. He personifies all of the paradise deities, which evolving mortals can discerningly comprehend. This Son and his spirit associate are your creator parents. To you, Michael, the Creator Son, is the supreme personality. To you, the Eternal Son, is super supreme, an infinite deity personality.
Okay, so most of that's pretty straightforward, but notice in the middle there, he personifies all of the paradise deities, you know, which evolving mortal can discernibly comprehend. You're going, well, wait a minute, he's got Father and Son, but he doesn't have spirit-type deity. Okay, yes, that's what I was saying. That's why they brought in the sevenfold, not directly. You know, and certainly not anything you can understand from the individuality viewpoint. But they purposely mention the sevenfold to remind you that really everything is subtly in there, very, you know, not immediately, you know, apparent ways, you know, recessive sorts of ways. Because the whole, the sevenfold is in there. And that, you know, what precedes that, see, to our universe and all its inhabited worlds, the sovereign Son is, to all practical intents and purposes, God. Okay, so why can you have that sentence? Because from an individuality viewpoint, he's one of the supreme creators in that whole collection of the sevenfold creators, you know, that are under that umbrella that you call God the sevenfold. Now, if it's God the sevenfold, well, then you can call him God. That's why you can call the Ancients of Days God. Master Spirit's God. Okay, but you can't call Eternals of Days God. They're not, you know, and the easiest way with to understand it, you know, is because from a unity viewpoint, there's one facet of deity and it's personalized. It's God. So from an individuality viewpoint, it's totally appropriate to call the Ancients of Days or Creator Sons God. Okay, yep.
Going back to the fact that the Son is the God and the Eternal Son, where does the Eternal Mother Son come in?
When he's brought into existence. That's actually, you know, coming up here. But just that, I mean, well, you can see it here. Go back to the beginning paragraph of this section. You know, when they say simultaneous origin in the universal Father and the Eternal Son. Okay, technically, that's the Eternal Mother Son there. It's the universal creator and the coordinate creator making a creator son. We talked about that. See, that's not the co-creator. That's the coordinate creator. That's the eternal mother son. And that's why a creator son has that recessive mother aspect where they can give rise to material daughters by themselves. They don't need to interface with the creative mother spirit to bring a material daughter into existence because they have eternal mother son nature within them. See, so you have that too. See, I mean, he's actually very complicated. I mean, you got the whole sevenfold thing in there that you a lot of times don't really talk about. There's the mother thing that occasionally, you know, but from an initial perspective, you just, to get to some understanding, you say, oh, think about the father hyphen son thing, and that gets you started. But then you can start thinking about these other subtleties in there. And I'm just trying to point out, see, occasionally, you know, they tell you things that are not comprehensible if all you have is father hyphen son. You know, it would not be true that he personifies all of the paradise deities. It would be two out of the three, see, from a simple point of view. But one of the, you know, one of the sevenfold creators is the conjoint actor. See? So it's in there in some subtle way. You know, and it's, you know, it's why he can have as close a relationship to a creative mother spirit that he does. Okay? Because in a sense, they're really one and the same thing from a unity viewpoint as God the sevenfold. You know, you take that one thing and you turn it into this whole vast, almost, you know, well, not even countable assortment if you count Frandalanx and Chronaldex, you know. I mean, it's this incredible individuality perspective, but it's just a singular thing from a unity point of view. Okay, but like they're saying, you know, they are your creator parents. I mean, you know, they italicize are there, because really, there's nothing you can conceive of beyond them right now. The Eternal Son is just in name only to us now. We can imagine that we have some distinct understanding of what the Eternal Son is, separate from a creator son, but it's just a conceptual, theoretical difference. We have no experience, you know, experience of the difference. We can't experience the difference yet. Okay, you know, we don't have anything that's remotely super supreme in our abilities yet to experience that difference. You're going to have to, you know, get to that which circuit of Avona before you can start to have these kinds of subtleties. Which circuit do you find the Sun on?
Six.
No. Right, the third you find the Father, so just back up. Right, right. Right. Okay.
I named four of them.
All right, go ahead.
Finish it up here.
In the person of the Creator Son, we have a ruler and divine parent who is just as mighty, efficient, and beneficent as would be the universal Father and the eternal Son if both were present on Salvington and engaged in the administration of the affairs of the universe of Nebadon.
Period.
How wonderful is that?
Yeah. So, again, despite all of these complexities of abstract thoughts and, you know, total deity and all this stuff, you know, they give you that bottom line. I mean, yeah. When all is said and done, the Creator Son is everything you could ever imagine, the universal Father, the eternal Son being right here with us, you know, devoting their whole existence to fostering our universe careers. So we lack for nothing. And it's important to, you know, they want to remind you of that because they're just telling you about sevenfold and stuff. And it's like, okay, you may be getting lost. No, you know, you actually haven't lost anything. They're everything you could ever want God to be, these Creator Sons, and more. They italicize more. Right? So, yeah. But once you have that, once you're not afraid to, you know, afraid that maybe the bases aren't being covered, you know, properly, then you can say, okay, so everything's fine. Now let me try to figure out exactly, how does that God the Sevenfold thing work again? That's what they're trying to get you, is comfortable. So you're not fearful and you can start to try to think about these complex things. All right, let's take a moment and reflect on it.